Into the Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Monday, March 25th, 2013, and this is podcast number 288. Today is a split podcast, two different interviews that I did last week. One is, the first one you're going to hear is about a 20-minute segment of a phone call that I had with Chris Edwards, the Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. And Chris and I had a real nice talk. It would have been a full interview, but Chris is a very busy person, and he is on a very tight schedule. So hopefully I'll have him back on the show again, and we can go into more in-depth on stuff. But what we were talking about was directly related to some of the other things that have been talked about on the podcast lately. And Chris had contacted me and sent me some emails giving me some information on what I had been talking about on some of the podcasts. So it was nice of Chris to email me and give me the information. And I thought, you know, I got to follow this up with actually talking to Chris and thanking him for it and everything. So we got about 20 minutes there that we recorded, and you'll get to hear it. That's what we're starting off with. And then after the call with Chris Edwards, you're going to hear the rest of my interview with Scott Horton from last week. And we will take off from discussing North Korea, and we'll go right on through the rest of it from there. So with nothing further, I give you my 20 minutes of my telephone call with Chris Edwards. I hope you enjoy it. And with me on the phone is Chris Edwards, the Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and he's also the editor of DownsizingGovernment.org. He's considered among the world's top experts in federal and state and tax budget issues. Chris, welcome to BadQuaker.com. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Especially considering that at times I've been critical of Cato, but generally I need to give a little bit of a disclaimer, even though, like I told you, I've criticized Cato sometimes for not taking a radical enough approach, but at the same time, the Cato Institute has provided some critical information on things like farm subsidies, infrastructure spending, the horrible war on drugs, the war overseas with, you know, the so-called war on terror, stuff that you're not going to get anywhere else. You can get really good information at the Cato Institute on those kind of things. Oh, and SWAT raids. The Cato Institute is a wonderful source for information on the abuse of SWAT raids. But so that's my sort of apology and disclaimer for kicking around the Cato Institute, Chris.
You know, the thing your listeners should know, actually, is that Cato scholars often can and do have their own particular opinions on issues that may differ from each other. So there is no Cato view on things. There is the individual scholars who are at Cato who are all we're all libertarians, but for example, you know, I might like the idea of scrapping the income tax and putting in place a flat tax. Another Cato scholar might like the idea of scrapping the income tax and putting in place a sales tax. Another Cato scholar might like the idea of scrapping the income tax and not replacing it with anything. So, you know, we have different views, but we're all libertarians.
And I followed your work for years, actually, and I was kind of surprised that you even knew that I existed. But I was flattered as well. But the articles that you shared with me were on specifically on infrastructure spending and road, so-called road building. And I wanted to quote a piece of one of your articles, and this is from Take the Public-Private Road to Efficiency was the name of the article, and I'll put links in today's show notes. And I just want to quote this one little section. It says, historically, Infrastructure in America was frequently provided by the private sector. In the 19th century, more than 2,000 turnpike companies built thousands of miles of toll roads. The great majority of America's vast railroad system was built without federal subsidies, and most urban rail and bus services were originally private. And I think America has almost entirely forgot that little piece of information right there.
Absolutely. I mean, for example, with the railroads, it's true that Lincoln signed the Pacific Railway Act of 1862 that subsidized a few of the railroads companies building railroads to the West by giving them free land. However, the vast majority of U.S. railroad mileage in the 19th century was in the East, where it was completely unsubsidized. And with regard to urban rail and bus services, this is a story that I think more Americans and libertarians and free marketers should understand, that up until the 60s, most American cities, they had private bus systems and they had private trolley and rail systems. And what happened in 1964, the federal government passed what was called the Urban Mass Transit Act. And what it did is it offered subsidies to cities. It offered money to cities for their city bus and rail services, but didn't give subsidies to any private company. So the immediately cities had this incentive to get rid of the private companies, to have a government run bus and rail system so that they could grab the subsidies from Washington. So very quickly the private urban transit companies disappeared, which is very unfortunate, because you know that now these days the city bus and transit systems are of course union dominated and horribly inefficient.
Yeah, imagine if that happened in a different segment of business. Let's say, you know, one day the federal government just decided, and maybe this is not all that outlandish to even predict, but let's say one day the federal government decided that it should subsidize restaurants. And so, you know, all across the country, city governments, there was this sudden infusing of federal money for city governments to take over the restaurant industries.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, this is one of my main themes over the years when I write about federal spending, is federal spending really corrupts innovation, low-cost experimentation, and competition at the state and local level. When federal money comes in, it creates this immediate disincentive for states and cities to allow entrepreneurs into businesses and to allow private sector competition, because immediately states and cities turn their attention to grabbing for federal subsidies. I mean, you see this with highways too. I mean, the fact that we have the federal government pumps out all this billions, tens of billions of dollars highway subsidies every year means that most of the focus of state officials is on how to grab more money from Washington, how to lobby Washington, rather than thinking about providing low-cost and innovative solutions there within the state. I mean, it changes the whole mindset of businesses when they take subsidies, and state and local governments when they take federal subsidies. It's really corrupting.
Are you familiar with Carl Fisher, the auto parts millionaire that built the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Lincoln Highway and so forth?
No, I'm not, actually.
He was a pretty amazing guy. I was hoping that you might have some information on him that I didn't know, actually. But he was started out selling headlamps for cars.
Right.
And made a fortune in that, went into auto parts, then later into auto dealerships. And he realized this was, now we're talking like 1908 or 1910, something
right.
like that. And he realized that where the problem was, he could sell more cars if he figured out a way to build more roads. And he did so by getting investors in one city, like in Indianapolis where he was at, he got investors to help him build roads all the way from Florida to Indianapolis, and all the way from, I believe it started out either in Philadelphia or New York, the Lincoln Highway, all the way to San Francisco, of course, going through Indianapolis. And so he was able to get private funding to build these highways. and did a pretty good job of it.
That's right. I mean, entrepreneurs always think of ways, I think of some government-centric folks always think that, you know, it's not possible for entrepreneurs to be able to afford and to fund certain investments. But entrepreneurs always, you know, think of ways to raise money and to do things in innovative ways. I mean, to give you one example, the trolley systems that sprouted in hundreds of American cities about a century ago, I guess starting in the 1880s, 1890s, part of the way that they were funded was that the trolley companies invested in land in some of the new suburbs that were sprouting around American cities. So, you know, these transit systems, there's a huge amount of investment required, but part of the return to these entrepreneurs was not only getting the passenger fares from the trolley systems, but also in the rise in the value of their land, which became more valuable because the trolley line went through the area. So, you know, and the private sector can come up with innovative ways of financing things if we would only open the doors and let them take a shot at it.
You know, Obama, and you mentioned this in one of your articles, Obama is pushing to spend a huge amount of money on the infrastructure, claiming that it's all crumbling and falling down. But really, the infrastructure is not just roads. The infrastructure is the whole backbone of all the industry, all the buildings and the, you know, all the workings that you don't necessarily think of that hold up industry. And really, the U.S. is in pretty good condition in infrastructure, isn't it?
Well, this is the interesting thing about infrastructure. I mean, thank God that all our infrastructure isn't provided by the government. In fact, most infrastructure in America is still provided by the private sector. And you can actually look at national income accounts, and you can look at gross fixed investment in the United States, meaning, you know, not just roads and schools and that sort of stuff, but oil refineries and pipelines and, you know, all kinds of, you know, facilities, factories and the like. And total private sector infrastructure spending is about five times as much as government infrastructure spending outside of defense. So luckily, you know, the private sector is still the main driver. And, you know, to me, the public policy implication of that is if we want more infrastructure, if we want more investment in hard assets in this country, we need to reform a regulatory and tax environment to get private sector companies investing. And, of course, the Keystone Pipeline would be a good example of that, of how, you know, government barriers can block beneficial private investment.
Also, you know, if you think of something you pointed out in one of your articles was that the government tends to, well, let's put it this way, in business, when somebody makes a mistake in business, there's an immediate learning curve that the business has to go through if they want to continue to function. But in government, you don't necessarily have the feedback mechanism that you have in the private sector. So government tends to they'll make a blunder, but since there's no learning mechanism, they'll just repeat that same blunder. So whether we're talking about, you know, high-rise public housing or light rail or their so-called what they're trying to pass off as high-speed rail, the government never learns from its blunders in those things and just keeps repeating the same mistakes.
That's exactly right. In particular, the federal government, because it's a single national monopoly, when it decides, when its experts decide to spend a lot of our money in something like high-speed rail, the problem is if it turns out to be a mistake, it replicates that mistake all across the country. And so, for example, state governments and local governments can make mistakes, but at least then other cities and other states can watch to see the innovation and experiment to see whether it works and to see whether they want to do it. But, I mean, you mentioned high-rise public housing. I mean, high-rise public housing, as I know your listeners probably know, you know, sprouted in dozens and dozens of American cities in the mid-20th century. It was fueled by federal subsidies. So Chicago, New York, and many other cities, St. Louis, all, you know, built, dove into this giant, terrible mistake of building these massive, you know, concrete warehouses, essentially, for poor people. It was a disastrous policy, but it was only possible because of all that flood of tens of billions of dollars coming from Washington. So that is why it's a real problem when the government gets involved in something, especially if it's the federal government, because they make the mistakes over and over across the country.
I remember reading, several years ago at the Cato Institute, there was a comparison of the efficiency of light rail as opposed to buses, as opposed to cars, as opposed to SUVs. And they actually figured out that the public, and this is obvious if you think about it a little bit, the public, the so-called public transportation like subways, light rail, that kind of thing, and buses are horribly inefficient because they run at off-peak hours with close to full, all the buses running when all the buses are empty. But then at actual peak hours, they're always overcrowded. There's no balance between those two. Whereas a business, you don't see McDonald's serving up 1,000 hamburgers at 3 o'clock in the morning when there's no customers. But that's kind of what cities do with buses and trains.
It is odd. I mean, as someone who works in a big city, that to see these city buses drive by constantly half empty, and then you'll see one bus, right after another going in the same direction, also half empty. It is kind of mind-boggling how government facilities work. Cato's Randy O'Toole has talked a lot about the inefficiencies when the government gets involved in transit and bus systems and the like. And, one issue that he's pointed out, which I think is a really good one, is that for the federal government since the 60s has provided mainly billions of dollars, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars for capital investment for city transit systems, but they generally haven't paid for the operating costs. So the incentive for cities is this: buses have a low capital cost and a higher operating cost, but transit, light rail, has a very high capital cost. Well, that's the cost that the federal government subsidizes. So city after city has gone after these elaborate, fancy light rail systems just because they could squeeze more money out of Washington for those systems than bus systems. And yet, as Randy pointed out, bus systems are almost always more efficient because they're more flexible. You can change the routes. But this, because the federal government is involved, it has created this bad incentive for cities to go for these expensive light rail systems. So, the solution to a lot of this stuff is let's get the federal government out, let's let the states and cities experiment by themselves and innovate and allow the private sector to come in and compete.
You were, I thought, rather kind in one of your articles, and I'll link to all these articles that I'm referring to here. I'll link in today's show notes. But you were rather, what I would consider rather kind to Ray LaHood, the current Secretary of Transportation, when in your article you kind of caught him up on what you called misleading statements in reference I understand in Washington you have to use the language of Washington, D.C., because you live there and you work there and everything. But his statements to me, out here in the Midwest, we just look at somebody and say, oh, you're a liar. But you can't do that in Washington, D.C.
I'll give you another example of a misleading statement. In the State of the Union address this year, President Obama made a big thing out of the fact that there were 70,000 structurally deficient bridges in America. And you often hear that statistic by people who want to spend more federal money on, fixing the bridges and the like. Well, what Obama didn't tell us was that the 70,000 is the numerator. The denominator is 600,000. There are 600,000 bridges in America. And so you get a ratio there of about 10%, I think, if my math is right. And so, the share of structurally deficient bridges in America, about 11%, sorry. So the share of structurally deficient bridges is about 11%. Well, that share has actually fallen dramatically over the last two decades from 22%. So Obama says, oh, it's horrible. There's 70,000 bridges that are falling down. But he doesn't tell us that, you know, the share of bridges that are in trouble keeps falling steadily and steadily and steadily every year. So, you know, our bridges in America are getting better. And if you look at federal government data, our highways are getting better. They're getting smoother. They're getting bigger. Our highways aren't, there's this narrative that our highways are crumbling and everything's falling apart. I think people should be very skeptical of that narrative. It's true, our highways, and some of our other infrastructure is getting more congested. But that's a different thing than claiming that, you know, we're not spending enough money so that they're all falling down.
Here, where I'm at in Ohio, and especially if you get more into eastern Ohio, there are a lot of places where a road has been rerouted and like 300 or 400 yards away from a brand new highway and a brand new bridge is an old, nearly abandoned or actually abandoned road and bridge. And when I saw that number, the 70,000 bridges, I thought, I wonder if Obama is counting these half abandoned or maybe not abandoned, but they're no longer giving them upkeep. I wonder how many of those bridges are included in his magical 70,000.
Well, that's right, and that's true for the American Society of Civil Engineers often complains about, for example, how many dams in America, water dams, are supposedly crumbling and the like. But they don't ask the question, you know, a lot of the dams we built in America were actually mistakes, in my view. They were government-subsidized boondoggles. And, you know, the fact that they're deteriorating is not necessarily a bad thing. And actually, they should be dynamited to let the rivers flow freely again. That's also, they complain about for our inland waterways, our barge canals and the like. It's a similar story. The people who want to spend more money say they're crumbling, but a skeptical view would be that, you know, the inland waterways, the demand for them has actually fallen off, as most, you know, the vast majority of freight in America goes on rail these days. We don't use the inland waterways much anymore. So, you know, a lot of these, I mean, these are difficult questions, but, you know, how much investment you do in different types of infrastructure. But from my point of view, let's let the private sector figure it out as much as we can. Let's let entrepreneurs, you know, run the inland waterways and as they do the freight rail to see, you know, how much investment is really the efficient amount.
Are you familiar with Walter Block's work on dealing with highway congestion at all?
Yeah, I certainly know who Walter Block is. I don't think I've read his articles on that issue.
You mentioned a moment ago about the congestion on the highways. Oh, I'm sorry. No, you mentioned about how the highways are getting smoother.
Right.
And I thought in my mind, yeah, the real problem is congestion.
Right.
My wife and I went all the way up the East Coast from Georgia all the way up to New Hampshire, through Washington, through New York, through, you know, the whole, we made a real mistake there, but anyway, the quality of the roads was not the problem.
Right.
The problem was trying to get through or around any of the major cities during the time frames when everybody else is trying to get around them.
That's true. And, you know, I think the congestion problem, it's certainly not universal. I mean, I spend a fair amount of time on the interstates in New York State. And frankly, because that state has depopulated over the decades, the same with some of the other northeastern states, frankly, the interstates, they've got beautiful interstates, and they're underutilized, or at least they're wide open. So, the congestion's around cities, but frankly, in a lot of rural areas, the interstates are, you know, a great investment, and they're smooth and well functioning, and so this problem is more of a regional thing, which is again one reason why it seems to me we ought to devolve power and control and financing of this infrastructure down to the state level. It is state policymakers who know what the condition of their highways is, and so it should be them, you know, figuring out how to fund them and how much investment they need.
Chris, I want to thank you for coming on the show with me today, and I want to remind everybody that they can find links to what we're talking about here at badquaker.com, links back over to the Cato Institute and the different articles that we've been talking about, and also your website, which is downsizinggovernment.org. People can just go to that, or if you, you know, if you can't remember what, how to spell that or whatever, just get to badquaker.com and I'll put a link to it, downsizinggovernment.org. Well, I guess you wouldn't have a problem spelling that, but anyway.
Now, Chris, just need to do it.
Yeah. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I appreciate your interest in these issues. I think the infrastructure issue is one of those issues. I think people need to be more skeptical about all these politicians who say we need to spend more money. I don't think it's the amount of money we spend. It's who spends it and how we spend it and how we raise it. Thanks a lot.
Time restraints didn't really allow us to go into how much waste there is and how much corruption and how money goes into the pockets of local governments from the government and then ends up going into contractors and then ends up going right back into the politician's reelection. We didn't have time to go into that, but maybe some other time we can do
absolutely
that.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Yep.
From June 17th through June 23rd of this year, the Free State Project will celebrate its 10th annual Porcupine Freedom Festival, Porkfest. My wife Cindy and I plan on attending, and Bad Quaker staff members Hannah and Matt are trying to raise enough money to attend, as they did last year. Considering fuel, campground fees, and Porkfest tickets, we estimate it will cost badquaker.com a little over $2,000 for Cindy and I to attend. For Matt and Hannah to attend, it will cost about $700 more. If you'd like to take part in sending the Bad Quaker crew to Porkfest 10, here's how you can do it. Go to badquaker.com. You can click on the donate button on the right-hand side of the page. You can also give us bitcoins with our bitcoin number located right below the donate button, or you can use our Amazon button to shop at Amazon. If you'd like to support badquaker.com on a regular basis, you can use the link to our forum and become a supporting member for only $4 a month or just $25 a year. Thanks, folks.
Well, that was, like I said, 20 minutes of my call with Chris Edwards, and I'm going to do what I can to try to get him back on the show for an actual interview for a full hour podcast. Chris was fascinating to talk to, and he's just a really nice guy. So now here is the second half of my interview with Scott Horton, and I hope you enjoy it. You know, what amazes me that we got all the way through the Bush years, and now we're almost through Obama years.
Sometimes, I know.
We're almost through the Obama years, and we haven't used these excuses to openly attack North Korea yet. I'm actually kind of shocked at that, because I fully expected excuses to be used, but I guess having, you know, the scary North Korea over there rattling a saber is always handy for them to have as a backup in case they ever need to do that.
Well, the problem with that is they've got nukes now because of George Bush and his pathetic, stupid lies and horrible policies. North Korea now has nukes, which means we can't mess with them. And think about what this means for the very few last rogue states in the world, right, where Bush declares the axis of evil, Iraq, Iran, North Korea, all three of them members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, all three of them with safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, all three of them verified to not be making nuclear weapons. So what does he do? He invades Iraq that has no kind of nuclear program to speak of whatsoever, and he threatens Iran that has a civilian nuclear program, and he threatens North Korea that has a civilian nuclear program. Well, North Korea, they back out of the treaty. They start making nukes, and we haven't laid a finger on them even rhetorically since, pretty much. I mean, Hollywood keeps saying that they're going to take us over, which is pretty funny. I think there's another new one like that coming out. But other than that, they haven't really done anything except leave little old North Korea alone. Then Muammar Gaddafi gives up his centrifuges that he bought from AQCOM, probably only for the purpose of giving them up. But anyway, he gives up his nuclear equipment, not that any of it was actually working at the time. And then what do? They kill him. They shoot him in the head on the side of the road and regime change him in favor of Al-Qaeda. So if you're the Iranians in this situation, what's the lesson? The lesson is hurry up and weaponize before it's too late. And now I'm not accusing them of that. And in fact, I'll be the first one to defend the fact that there's no evidence anywhere on the planet that they're actually pursuing the weaponization of their nuclear program whatsoever. I mean, their entire policy has been, our hands are up, don't shoot, this whole time. But as far as American policy goes, the lesson is clear. If you cooperate with us, we'll kill you anyway. And if you make nuclear weapons, then what are we going to do? We can't touch you. We are sufficiently deterred, right? Because they can nuke Seoul. I mean, and in fact, you know, they've done three nuclear weapons tests, and they've all apparently been fizzles, meaning they sort of kind of worked. They got some kind of bang, but not the full chain reaction they're going for. And that's because they've got, unlike in Bush's false accusations, they didn't have a weaponized uranium program. They only have plutonium that they could harvest from their Soviet-era nuclear reactors. And then to set off a plutonium bomb, you need very sophisticated implosion systems that are very, very difficult to come across, with the different high explosive charges timed down to the microsecond in order to get it to work just right. And so they haven't been able to get it to work just right. But you know what? Half an atom bomb a few miles from Seoul, South Korea, is enough to deter the Americans so far. So they can beat their chest over there, and they can beat their chest in Washington, D.C., but hopefully they're not going to do much about it. The only thing I have left to say about North Korea, real quick before I shut up, is that when their new dictator, the grandson, was threatening to nuke us with nukes that he couldn't possibly fit on missiles that he doesn't even have, a couple of weeks ago, the American response from the State Department was, bring them on. We're not afraid. We have all the capabilities in the world to shoot down any incoming missiles from North Korea. Well, again, they don't have the missiles to do it, not yet anyway, and maybe a very long time before they could even hit Alaska. But for the Democrats, that's their foreign policy. That's their that's what they have to say about North Korean threats. Is, you know, assuming the actual legitimacy of the threat of a nuclear missile headed our way, go ahead and try it, was basically what the State Department said, which, you know, kind of makes me miss George W. Bush, because that's, at least in his second term, he was better on North Korea than that. I mean, Obama hasn't done a thing. Bush tried actually pursuing negotiations in his second term.
You know, I can't help but to think how much these goons in Washington, D.C. seem to me like 12-year-olds on the internet for the first time. You know, the legendary internet tough guy that's ready to push everybody around and ready to fight everybody, but it's not in reality. It's all just mouth. It's typing, you know, from their mom's basement or whatever.
Right. Yeah, that's what they are. And you know, I think if you anybody who's a real C-SPAN aficionado knows that they know more than the people on C-SPAN about most of this stuff. I mean, whatever it is, as you know, whatever your topic is anyway, if you watch the congressmen and the senators, it's very rare, isn't it, that you go, wow, man, that guy, even if he's wrong, that guy really knows what he's talking about. I mean, right?
Yeah,
I watched Ron Paul for 10 years try to teach economics to Barney Frank, and now look at us and the mess we're in. You know, it didn't take. It can't take.
My daughter and I were joking yesterday or the other day, whichever day it was, about the one congressman that was talking about Guam tipping over. And it just, I know it happened a long time ago, but yeah. I can't get that out of my head, how comical it is that someone would believe that.
Yeah, I mean, what is an island anyway? What is this planet that I'm on? Where am I? What day is it? I have no idea. Put me in Congress. Yeah, I mean, one the other day where Maxine Waters said that 270 million jobs will be lost or something like that. That's almost the entire population of the country. I mean, what? Again, like, how do you make a mistake like that? I mean, you can only make a mistake like that if you don't know anything. If you have no fact, like Carl Sagan said, right, just floating, lost in the dark, right, without a single real fact to ground your feet in and to stand upon in order to try to do your best to ascertain other facts, right? Just floating lost in the dark. 270 million, why not? I don't know.
I was talking to Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute not long ago, and we were joking around about the Obama's statement that 70,000 bridges in America were threatened to collapse if we didn't spend a whole bunch of money on bridges. And I was like, are they including bridges and like people's decorative bridges in their backyards, or because the numbers just don't add up. The Cato Institute has all these numbers, and this is just a number they pulled out of somewhere that we can't mention on the radio.
Right. Yeah, somewhere.
Hey, let me interrupt our flow and save this file, and we'll stick another commercial in here. And would you be kind enough to stick with me for a few more minutes?
Sure.
Okay, we'll be right back with Scott Horton.
BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com.
Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Folks, thanks for sticking with me through the break. With me is Scott Horton, and Scott's website is really easy to find, scotthorton.org. And he has a live show Monday through Friday, except for Thursday. And that's why I'm able to talk to him today, because I'm actually recording this Thursday. Scott, I'm really happy to have gotten with you and got you on the Bad Quaker podcast. You're one of the people in the Liberty Movement that I've really looked up to and I've learned so much from over the years. And I should correct myself. I'm trying to move away from calling it the Liberty Movement, because that sounds very trendy and faddish, and I'm trying to call it the Liberty Mission, because we're not just a bunch of kids wearing mini skirts and long hair. We're actually trying to accomplish something. We have a goal here, and one of those goals is peace. And I'm not sure of anybody, Scott, that's been at that fight longer and more consistent than you. There's a lot of people that make a lot of noise, but when we talk about consistently, I really appreciate your consistency on fighting for peace.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate that a lot. And I mean, I can't figure out what's more important than this, right? I mean, it's, as we talked about before, it's the biggest, the worst, the most violent government program, the most corrupt, the most based on lies, the least justifiable of really anything going on the planet right now. I mean, almost the whole planet is at peace except for America's wars right now, believe that or not. This is, in a great many ways, a very golden age, and yet American, not that it's utopian or anything like that, but it's, things are getting a lot better in a lot of places around the world. And American foreign policy seems to be hell-bent on screwing it up rather than helping it along or just leaving it the hell alone. And so when I get up in the morning, my thing is, who's best on the most horrible stuff? And let me ask them why it is the way it is. I mean, I don't know what else to do.
I've often wondered, we've talked about Afghanistan, we talked about Iraq, we talked about North Korea, and I've often wondered, when people who have in the past supported all of this aggression on the part of the American government, when they saw what happened across North Africa and they saw who Washington, D.C. supported in all those conflicts, how I don't know how a person justifies continuing to lie to themselves and thinking, oh no, you know, Washington's got the best interests of everybody in their mind, and that's why they're doing these things. Well, then why are they shoveling money at the Muslim Brotherhood or at Al Qaeda or at, you know, these other organizations that they demonized for years, and then they prop them up in these governments that they right after overthrowing these other guys. I don't understand that.
Well, you know, I'm always really torn on this. On one hand, I can see sort of a divide-and-conquer policy behind the thing, and I can imagine where, if I was a general in the Pentagon and I wanted to sow conflict so that I could have more conflicts to be involved in for the next little while, then I could follow a policy like this. But on the other hand, if you really break it down into its smallest pieces, it really does seem like narrow-minded, short-sighted stupidity. And the best example, we can talk about Syria in a second, it's an extremely important one. But on Libya, it occurred to me at the time, I said this at the time, and then later on things came out that made me think that I was right. See, and that was that the reason they took the side of the rebels in Libya was because they looked really bad after Tunisia and Egypt. When the Arab Spring broke out, it was just so obvious. There was just no escaping it, even in American media, but especially in any international media and on the internet and whatever. It was just 1,000% crystal clear that Uncle Sam is the bad guy. Uncle Sam is the black-cloaked emperor, the Sith Lord behind every dictator in the region. In Morocco, in Algeria, in Libya, where Gaddafi was our sock puppet and had been since 2003, like we were just talking about in the North Korea story there, in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, Yemen, UAE, Kuwait, Iraq, Jordan. The only countries we don't control over there is Syria that much, even though they torture people for us from time to time, and Iran anymore, since they had a revolution and declared their independence back in 1979. But other than that, if there's tyranny in the Middle East, if there's a sultan or an emir or a king or a potentate calling himself a president anywhere between Morocco and India, America's behind them. And everyone knew it. It had never been more clear, like all at once, when the Arab Spring revolutions broke out. And in the case of Egypt, they did everything they could to keep Hillary Clinton's, quote, family friends, the Mubarak's in power, Hosni Mubarak and his wife, and their regime in power, up until the very, very end. And they were so clumsy, they were putting it, and I don't think this was because they were being too clever by half. I think they really were this clumsy. They were saying, we want so badly to keep Hosni Mubarak, but if we can't get him, if he has to go, then I guess we'll settle for Omar Suleiman, the head of the secret torture police. And the people of Egypt, really what happened was, Mubarak had the senior officers pull the junior officers to see whether they would massacre all the protesters in Tahrir Square, and they said, no, but we'll massacre you, and so that was it. Game over, and he left. The Americans, I think, probably would have had him stay in power at all costs, but the junior officers in his military would not go along. They identified with their family members in Tahrir Square before identifying with the state. And so the game was up, Mubarak had to go, and they didn't get Suleiman either. They've had to settle for the Muslim Brotherhood, which the Muslim Brotherhood, they're like the Republicans of Egypt. I mean, they might be Islamists, but they're not radicals. I'm sure we would all disagree with many of their positions, but they're really much more like conservatives. They really are doctors and lawyers and property owners and people who aren't into big disruptions. I mean, you could call them fascists maybe, but they're not bomb-throwing revolutionaries who want to start a war with the United States at all costs, like Osama bin Laden or something like that. If you ever listen to Ayman al-Zawahiri talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, you know that al-Qaeda does not approve of their participation in Western-style democracy or even statehood, for that matter. So I'm trying to get to my point. Sorry, Ben. So then in Libya, when the protests broke out in Libya, this was Hillary Clinton's idea of a chance to at least confuse the issue and say, look, everybody, America is that cartoon Superman that liberated France from the Nazis back in the day that everybody loves so much and always supports the underdog. And so here we are on the side of the rebels against Gaddafi, who they had invited back in the cold, back in from the cold in 2003, but was still kind of erratic and was asking for a lot of protection money for his oil and wasn't coming through on all the armored personnel carriers that John McCain was trying to sell him. And so, you know, he was expendable. But like you said, who was the replacement? Who comes after Gaddafi and his sons? Well, when they fought the war, it wasn't the people of Libya like in some, you know, sociology class experiment or something like that. It was the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. It was the Libyan veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq who had survived and come home and were now being backed and really led by American and European special forces on the ground and American bought and armed and financed European planes in the air. Who fought that war, which of course led to, if you want, we could talk about how it led to the war in Mali, but suffice to say some of Gaddafi's armed mercenaries were Tuaregs from Mali who took their weapons and went home upon losing, but not dying, and restarted their revolution for northern Mali, which has, you know, led us to a terrible situation that's continuing to this day. But then also it's led to, as you're saying, basically, Islamist rule in Libya, and not even anyone rule in Libya. It's sort of Mad Max time in Libya right now, with different militias and tribal groupings fighting against each other, and with arms and fighters traveling to Syria, where America is also backing the jihadists, in this case against the Shiite-backed Baathist dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad. But I'll go ahead and stop. But just to fill you in and tell you you're right, Ben, I mean, that's basically the project now, is financing the guys who were al-Qaeda in Iraq in the last war.
That's just amazing. I've read a little bit about also this question of the Libyan gold. What's your opinion? I'm sure you probably know about the accusations in that realm that there was no Libyan, the central bank or whatever in Libya was not cooperative with the EU and the Federal Reserve, and then all of a sudden all this gold disappeared and a new bank popped up in Libya?
I don't know about that. I actually, I'm not so sure about that whole petrodollar or not and gold currency type cost of spelling. I once actually wrote a thing about the possibility that that was part of the motivation for getting rid of Saddam Hussein, that he didn't want to deal in petrodollars anymore, and then there was the big story a few years back about the Iranian oil bourse and that they would have their own kind of oil market and they would denominate it in euros or gold or something else, and that, you know, maybe that was part of the thing. But then what happened was I interviewed a guy who had actually, he was a Brit who had, and no radical either, who had come up with the idea for the Iranian oil bourse and had written all about it. And from his point of view, anyway, it had nothing to do with challenging American hegemony or the Dutch or British monopoly on controlling that, you know, having the actual oil markets in their countries and that kind of thing in any meaningful way, that it was such small percentages of the total game that it really wouldn't have any kind of effect like that big enough to make anyone in the West mad. It was only a matter of just easing transactions and, you know, modernizing the system and whatever. And so I kind of, maybe that wasn't 100% right, but I sort of thought that, you know, they're debasing the currency and risking the American dollar dominance by all this inflation to fight all these wars a hell of a lot more than they need to worry about the dollar being undermined by any one country or couple of countries deciding to diversify out of dollars at any one point. You know what I mean? But then again, it's not like these people are very good at math, apparently, so I don't know, man. Maybe that really is it, and I'm missing the forest for the trees or something.
Well, I've kind of wondered if that was part of the, you know, there's a very large market out there in selling gold and playing off of people's fears, whether justified or not, of coming financial collapse. So I've kind of wondered if some of that was disinformation, not from governmental sources, but just from people going, hey, here's an opportunity to sell some gold if we can get people, you know, upset about this. But I don't know one way or the other. That's pure speculation on my part.
Right, like gun shop owners for Obama, that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
He's really good for the bottom line there.
Okay, well, we kind of picked on Syria a little bit. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to – what's your wild guess or educated guess as to what that's going to look like in a couple of years?
Absolute disaster. And, you know, my only saving grace on this, Ben, is that I don't know that much about Syria. So my imagination of just how bad it's going to be is still a pretty rough outline. But when I talk to people like Patrick Coburn, and not just him, but, you know, David Enders from Clatchy Newspapers and all these other great reporters who are covering Syria, they all basically fear the worst. A Lebanon-style 15-year multi-ethnic, multi-faction, multi-militia, the tribal civil war of death and pain and foreign intervention and suicide bombings, and it's only just begun. And now here's the thing about that. That sort of assumes that the Assad regime is going to fall to this rebellion. Now, here's a couple, well, the big argument for that happening is the rebels are backed by the West. And the American people, we can afford to change your regime one way or the other. Maybe we'll have to escalate the thing into a full-scale air war or even a ground war or something like that. It won't be as easy as a big east-to-west front movement like the war in Libya. That simply was a matter of time. It took a long time. It took 9 months to finally sack Tripoli once the war started. But it was simply a matter of time there. It won't be quite as easy in Syria. But I think it probably would take escalation in order to actually change the regime, because at this point, the rebels have not been able to take any of the cities. I mean, they had sort of kind of dominance in Aleppo there for a while, but then the government mostly took it back. And Patrick Coburn, who's been there recently, says that the government controls every major city in the country. So, yes, the Sunni-based rebellion, which is led by al-Qaeda type, you know, prisoner beheaders and suicide bombers, that they do control big parts of the countryside, but so what? You know, they don't control Damascus, they don't control Aleppo, and they don't control the state. And at this point, the Assad regime has majority support of the population of the country, and they have very motivated backers in the form of basically every faction except the Sunni Arabs. Now, I guess the Kurds are kind of split for and against the regime. And I read a thing recently that some of the Druze were, that's D-R-U-Z-E, not Jews, the Druze, and I don't know what the hell that means, actually, by the way. It's some kind of religious ethnic division, but I don't know what. But anyway, they've kind of retained their neutrality, I think. I don't know about split fighting for both sides, but I think they're trying to stay out of it. But otherwise, all the Shiites and the Alawites, which is a kind of Shiite sort of, and all of the different factions of Christians and or anyone else you throw in at random there, they are all backing the regime because they face an absolute nightmare future if the regime falls. I mean, that's what the Ba'athist Alawite tyranny basically is the only thing standing between them and getting their heads cut off at this point. And the rebels have made that clear that, oh, we're going to cut your head off. You know, I mean, that's basically their thing. And so these are the guys that the CIA is organizing the whole war for, the beheaders. Fighting, you know, in Iraq, we fought against the Sunni-based Ba'athists in favor of the Iranian-backed Shiites. In Syria, we're backing the al-Qaeda in Iraq types in Syria against the Iranian-backed Shiite Ba'athists, which is a little bit confusing, but anyway, now you get it. And so, in other words, America created the Shiite crescent that they feared so much in turning Iraq over to Iran's best friends and the Dawah Party and that kind of thing. They've created this massive Iraq-Iran Syria alliance, and so if they can't reinvade Iraq and do a regime change back in favor of the Saudi-backed Sunnis there, at least they can try to take out Assad. And so anyway, I'm sorry for just going on and on, Ben, but the point being that America is backing the jihadists. Oh, and here's one more very important point to make about that too, is that in Iraq you had a very broad-based It was a predominantly Sunni-based insurgency, but it was an Iraqi, mostly nationalist insurgency against the American occupation. And the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, quote-unquote guys, were not the leaders of it, and they were not it. They were 5% or less of it. Mostly, it was agreed, 2 or 3% of the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq were the Al-Qaeda in Iraq guys, the ones who were sending the suicide bombers to the marketplaces and cutting off people's heads and that kind of thing. Well, there's this great reporter from a McClatchy newspaper named David Enders who's been going to Syria and reporting from there. And he reported on Iraq back in the day. That's how I know him. And I asked him, you know, that being true, is that the same thing going on in Syria where you have a broad-based rebellion, but the Al-Qaeda fringe 2% end up taking all the headlines because they're cutting off heads and setting off suicide bombs? And he said, no, Al-Qaeda in Syria is the rebellion. There is no broad-based Sunni rebellion in Syria. They call them the Al-Nusra Front. Even though Obama administration, when they're trying to gain plausible deniability and claim that they're not attempting to back these guys, call them Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's what they said. They put them on the official terrorism, they gave them the MEK's place on the terrorist list, I guess, and said these guys are Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're indistinguishable from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That was the New York Times version, the administration's version, and yet they continue backing them anyway. They've been backing them this whole time, and it's the CIA coordinating the Turks and the Saudis and the Qataris and the Jordanians, training them in Jordan. And now the thing is, they keep saying that they're trying to train and finance and back moderates and try to marginalize the jihadists. And I think that actually that's partially true, but I think I really believe that's mostly just plausible deniability. They know that when you're sending this money and even this training and these weapons into Syria, that it's the crazies are the ones who do the fighting. There's nobody anybody ever called a moderate that went out there and fought on the front line in a revolution. You know what I mean? It's the Al-Qaeda guys are doing the fighting there. And they're the ones who end up with all the guns and the money and you know, maybe the future of the country. And that backing at the same time that they cry that they're trying not to. And they keep saying, in fact, their spin now is, Ben, that, you know what, Scott, you're right. Al-Qaeda in Syria is the rebellion. So that's why we need to intervene, you know, to marginalize them and prop up pro-American rebels who are nowhere to be seen. You know, Hillary Clinton even created this fake government in Qatar to install as the new coalition government of the rebels in Syria. And her sock puppets immediately declared loyalty to the Al-Qaeda fighters at the front. Because they have to. That's the only prayer at legitimacy that they have, because that's who the rebels are. And so now why are they doing this? Okay, Barack Obama, the president of the United States, gave an interview to Benjamin Netanyahu's best friend in the American media, Jeffrey Goldberg, at The Atlantic, and they agreed that this is all about weakening Syria in order to weaken Iran. I mean, if they can get an outright regime change, great. Weakening them is second best, and just bogging Assad down is second best. But neither of them, Jeffrey Goldberg or Barack Obama, even pretended for a moment to invoke the poor refugees and the poor starving children and the poor unfortunate civilian masses of Syria who need saving from their big bad dictatorship. They didn't even pretend. It's right there in The Atlantic. Jeffrey Goldberg says, geez, President Obama, this thing in Syria could be a great way to hurt Iran, don't you think? And Obama says, yes, it sure is. Please tell Netanyahu I said that, you know, and whatever. I mean, there it is, right there. What is this about weakening Iran? Why? Well, because they had the audacity to declare independence from us and have a civilian nuclear weapons program, which apparently is considered the vaguest of existential threats by Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel.
Scott, I wish we could do this for a couple more hours. I'm learning so much with every word that you say. Let's let the people know how they can, I've said a couple times, but how they can listen to you. You've got scotthorton.org, and you're also over there on No Agenda Global Radio. And
NoAgendaStream.com. And also there's this thing called TalkStreamLive.com, which I'm brand new over there. But they seem to be like a clearinghouse of all different talk radio going on all at the same time. So really want to try to build up my numbers over there if people want to check that out. And thank you very much for having me, Ben. It's been a good time.
Oh, I'm just honored and pleased to have you on the show. And one other thing for the listeners, go over to scotthorton.org and hit the archive button. And there's just hours and hours and hours of great stuff there. Scott, thanks a lot for coming on the show with me. And let me just extend an open invitation. If you ever want to come back on again, drop me a note.
Sure, and I'd be happy to do it anytime. So vice versa there, too.
Thanks a lot.
All right, see ya.
And that was my interview with Scott Horton. And I want to thank you for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thank you very much, folks.